wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
We are not, I guess we are in the canteen of the new basement studios.
Well, the new non-basement studios by the lake?
Yeah, I guess that's one way of putting it. We're not in the basement, we're above.
Yeah, this is we've been doing our podcast recently virtually over Skype or whatever app we were using.
That's right.
And this one, we're actually in the same place because it's going to involve food, which we will discuss in a moment. But as a result, we thought we needed to be in the same place. You did propose at one point to deliver a bunch of the cheeses. Oh, sorry, I gave it away. Cheeses is a food.
We are doing cheese today.
Yeah, you did propose at one point to deliver those in advance and we would do them remotely, but we went ahead with cutting in person. So in order to be safe, I think you had mentioned, hey, I've got a 6-foot-long cord. We could just be really, really far away from each other.
Yeah.
But I realized today as I was setting up here that we have a set of glass doors in the house that separate two rooms. It used to be an exterior door. That's the room you're in was a porch once upon a time. That's why you have a brick wall on one side of you. And so I basically realized, well, we could just close the glass doors and be on each side of it, and it's almost like a little studio.
Yeah, it is.
It's not perfect in that because it's glass doors and I'm in a kitchen area. The noise is not exactly, we're a bit better soundproofed in the basement.
Yeah, studio. It's probably going to feel more echoey to you all. But to your point, I actually feel like this is the real deal in that I'm looking through a window at someone else. Mm-hmm. I feel like maybe you're Howard Stern and I'm Robin.
No. Oh.
Or vice versa.
I'm trying to figure out which one's better or worse. I don't know which one I want to be.
So anyway, my partner there made every effort to bury the lead, and he did not. We are going to test some cheese and have a discussion about cheese.
Right. We've done a number of food and beverage tasting events before, certainly some beer tastings. We've done coffee tasting. We did burger tasting.
That's right.
And we're overdue for chicken sandwich testing.
But we did do fried chicken, if you go back into our archives. Remember, we did the road trip where we went to Popeyes, we went to an independent chicken. But I don't think we didn't do chicken sandwiches per se.
So have you seen on YouTube, there's a, I think it's called Try or something like that, but it's all Irish people trying out various products. You know, some are American, some aren't, and they, you know, it's like a, it's, they must have a half a dozen or more in each show, and it's two at a time that are at a table tasting this product and just being, I don't know if you'd say various Irish stereotypes.
Okay.
But a little bit. Yeah. You know, like there's you know, the tough punk rocker guy, you know.
And so what sort of products is
so this
it?
Is what's interesting. Like some of the products are, and one of them they did chicken sandwiches, and it's American chicken sandwiches, right?
Okay.
So like I think they came over here and did some, so it was
they must have a bigger budget than us.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they are on YouTube and it keeps getting pushed up into my feed, so I assume
really?
It must be doing well enough. But they, you know, they compared Chick-fil-A versus Popeyes versus Wendy's. I can't remember the fourth or fifth. And, you know, again, because I think they're not, if we had done it, we would made sure it was apples to apples. Like, so for example, on the Popeyes chicken sandwich, they did that one. But then when they did the Chick-fil-A, they did the deluxe, which has lettuce and tomato.
A very different sandwich.
Right, yeah. It like completely changes what it is.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like some of these other ones, it just didn't line up. And they've done a number of booze ones, and they did one that was American bourbon, but like one brand did I recognize. Like a bunch of the other ones, it was like somebody who had never had any exposure to bourbon at all grabbing a bunch of brands off the shelf. And they did one recently that was oh my God, I always blank out on the name of the wormwood liqueur, absinthe, right? But I could, like, the absinthe they had, like, they were just trying to have the strongest absinthe. And, like, they had, like, one was green, which is sort of its official color, but this was fake green.
Yeah.
And one was, like, black, and one was red. I'm like, there's no red absinthe. I don't know what you guys are drinking there, and, you know. But it's still pretty entertaining.
It was interesting because I remember when we did our bourbon show.
Yeah.
That I felt that was more, because it had been your resolution, and I think that was about 3 or 4 years ago, because I didn't drink it at all, it wasn't so much as I never felt that show was a taste test. I felt that show was an education,
right,
and that you were helping me go from one to another.
Yeah.
And the point I'm making is, if these chaps on this show try come over and they have no background of knowledge,
right?
There's really no
educational component to it. It's just quite for them to go, oh my goodness, that's strong, or those chips are horrible. They tasted the different flavors of Oreos. Like, you know, Oreo has like a lot of different flavors.
Yeah.
It turns out carrot cake Oreo was a big hit with them.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. But, well, I mean, they are an agrarian culture, so he eats carrots and everything.
Yep. So, I don't know if there are any other preambles, but I just interjected a bunch of things. No preambles.
But again, we had discussed for a little while, and I know regular listeners have heard us say, yeah, we're going to do a cheese taste test. So I went to a shop near me, which is a cheese shop. And I want to give a shout out to Nick at Cheese Steak. I promised we will tweet them when the show goes out. They were very helpful. But I remember walking in Friday evening, back end of rush hour. I've just been to work. I've wandered into the cheese store thinking, oh, I need to get some cheese for the show. And this is also clearly a reflection of a lack of planning on my part. I'm suddenly looking at cases with about 200 cheeses, and I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah. So I decided I've bought 5 cheeses, and I think it would be fair to say there's no rhyme or reason in terms of, you know, kind of what we've selected. But we have selected to finish, just bought an off-the-rack cheese from the store to see how that holds up compared to a lot of very nice cheeses, nice expensive cheeses. So the only thing I didn't buy, I didn't do any soft cheese because I'm not a huge fan of soft cheese.
Well, that's tough under the studio lights too. You might lose control of it.
Regular cheese will sweat, but soft cheese will just melt. Mm-hmm. And you're better off having a sweaty cheese than a melting cheese. Yes.
Yeah, I didn't give you a napkin over there behind the glass, so you have to wipe your hands off.
That's all right. I've got clothes on, so I'll work accordingly. And I must say, on this side of the glass, I am already smelling cheese off my cheese plate.
Oh, there you go.
So, yeah. So, obviously, these are very pungent cheeses.
That gets to a certain point. By the way, remind me to come back to, like, when you mentioned all the different types of cheese, but I'm sure I'll stumble into it. But the fact that you're smelling it actually gets into the question of how you taste cheese, right?
Right.
So, I mean, to some extent, it's obvious. You stick it in your mouth and you chew on it. You know, make sure you don't just swallow it whole or something like that. You want to get a chance to actually taste what's going on. But they mentioned the first thing that the two different places I looked at, they're not fancy cheese websites, but various food-related websites and wine-related websites, is smell your cheese. And, you know, most people know there's so much of what you taste that's really coming from your nose. And so it's very important that you smell your cheese. And they recommend, you know, we've got it on something cool just so it doesn't get too nasty. But, you know, you don't necessarily really want to have cold cheese. You'll taste it more and you'll smell it more.
Right.
If it's a little warmer, and they recommend crumbling it up a little bit with your hand. I mean, I don't recommend doing this if somebody's hosting a party and it's, you know, wine and cheese or whatever it is. I don't recommend going over to the table and rubbing it with your hands. But if you're literally going to taste cheese by yourself, they talk about, like, you know, the warmth from your hand and crumbling it and, you know, smelling it that way, kind of crumbling it up to the extent you can. Soft cheese doesn't work that way.
Well, I do want to come. I just want to briefly backpedal on the point that you made there about the refrigeration aspect and the room temperature aspect. If I am correct, and you did make some notes about cheese production.
Yeah.
Cheese is a product that is kept in the fridge, yet it is not made.
Again, and not all cheese really has to be kept in the fridge.
Yes.
And it probably is going to keep longer, and it's generally...
It's a very sort of modern thing that it's a product that we put in the fridge, but historically...
Oh, sure,
cheese is something that was around before refrigeration.
Yeah, we'll talk more about the history of cheese, but it well predates anything that where you'd have a refrigerator. So it was a lot of it was about preserving the proteins and milk once they figured out how this stuff was made, is they could kind of lock it up and hold on to a food so you didn't have to, you know, go straight from cow or goat or whatever animal it was you're taking milk from and stick it in your mouth before it goes bad.
So do you want to give the listener any more on how cheese is made? Just some of the basic principles?
I think we got to get to the tasting.
Yeah, let's
start. We usually try to break it up so that, you know, we're not tasting them all in a row. Yeah. I did want to mention, in terms of the wine piece, you said something about the wine that the Nick had mentioned to you. It's worth mentioning as long as we're talking about tasting.
So here's an interesting thing. I was, again, and this was one of those boutique cheese stores. It has a small restaurant. restaurant. They are a small chain in our area. They're called Cheese Steak. They have a couple of stores. You can go in there and you can, they tend to have small cafes in them. You can get a very nice grilled cheese sandwich. And I do want to share something that I had there recently, which is a related cheese product, but we will bring that up a bit later as we go through our cheeses. I was discussing with him and you know, I was buying all these quarter pounds of cheese.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of felt like, because I was taking his time, and he had to pull them out of the rack and cut them. You know, the other people were having to help other customers. So I felt I needed to explain what I was doing. And I said, oh, you know, the Atlantic Voice podcast, we are going to be doing a cheese show. And he threw me a tidbit about, well, are you guys going to drink anything with it? And I said, no, we're just going to taste the cheese. And then we got into a conversation where he always recommends to people that if you're having more expensive cheese and having a proper cheese sort of tasting experience, he always recommends that people should have some sort of white wine, because white wine has that sort of acid, that fruity acid that cuts through the flavor. And he said he has recommended to people who've come in and bought a quarter pound of a $45 cheese. And so he's sort of had a conversation. They've said, yeah, we're going to have our Cabernet Sauvignon. And he's like, no, don't be doing that. You will ruin the experience. He is of the opinion that white wines go so much better with hard, pungent cheeses. Although I will say this. One of my most favorite vacation experiences was going to France and just eating brie and drinking red wine.
Well, sure. Yeah.
So I don't know. Now, to be fair, though, I was just eating cheese and drinking wine. Rather than being a connoisseur.
It wasn't that you weren't savoring the cheese, but you weren't sort of really trying to grate it.
Yeah, no, to plowing it back, to be fair.
So which one of these cheeses are we supposed to start with?
We have plates in front of us, and do you want to... We're going to start. I bought something called a Beecher's Cheddar.
Mm-hmm.
And Beecher's are a cheesemaker out in Washington State. It does look like when you go to their website, they are packaging cheese very traditional, sort of a, trying to think of a cross between, if you think of Boar's Head as your mass producer of deli cheeses for the store,
Right. These
guys are trying to be more sort of rustic in terms of their product. But at the end of the day, when you go to their website, it's showing everything you get sealed in plastic and sent to you. So I'm going to try it. It is a cheddar. It's the Beecher's Cheddar.
Yeah, I'm going to break it here, do a little smelling. I think it's like a ripe milk smell. I mean, that might sound redundant, but it's not like no extras.
There's nothing very potent about it. And I say that from an odor perspective.
And ultimately, the
Northern European cheddars and to a lesser extent the Dutch Edams tend to be quite low on. They're not the smelliest of cheeses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cheddar is a cheese that I think is obviously not manufactured is the wrong word, but is made to eat in quite large amounts.
Yeah, it's crumblier than you'd think of. Like a lot of people, you get a block of cheddar, you know, orange cheddar. You slice it. You would not be able to use a thin slices of this, you know,
because this is crumble. A light yellow. You mentioned orange cheddar. This is a light yellow cheddar. What I equate to an English cheddar, which is what I grew up with.
Yeah,
and so you're cutting big slabs of that to stick it on your bread.
Well, even that, it breaks very readily and irregularly breaks, and it's when you bite down. I don't know if you notice this. There's like a It's almost like a little crunch at times, not a lot of it.
Yeah, I noticed that. Almost like maybe, I thought maybe your plate was dirty.
No.
And I was getting some stuff.
I was reading a lot of these cheeses have some crystals in them, and I imagine that's what it is that they're like little bits of how the ingredients come together, is there's a crystallization at a very, like you can't see anything, but definitely like,
no.
As soon as you bite down.
And it happens on every bite, so.
So Beecher's, this is their flagship, right? It doesn't actually on their website mention anything about it being cheddar, so I didn't really look anything up about cheddar in advance. Some of the other ones I'll mention, I did look up stuff about the type of cheese generally, but it comes from Seattle's historic Pike Place Market, first sold in 2003, So these are really serious Johnny come latelys to the cheese scene, I imagine, just like everything else with craft beers and all those things. This is all part of that, back to the artisanal nature of it.
Well, that was my sense. And it was interesting, though, when I was in the store, it didn't have any. The only thing that identified it as Beecher's was a handwritten note. So clearly, unlike their website, where stuff seems like it's shipped in plastic with their logo all over it, when it actually showed up in the store, it was in very plain wrapping, and it was just a handwritten note that said it was Beecher's. And I cannot decide now if that's some
sort of sleight of hand. Did they just take the plastic wrapping off?
To make them seem, to your phrase, more artisanal than they really are. It is a cheddar. But I'm not going to lie, and I don't want to make it all about price. All the cheeses that we taste, apart from the last one, they were all north of $27 a pound. So they're all in this range of $27 to $34. So these are, even though, and I think it's interesting, when you talked about, you know, orange cheddar. Cheddar is one of the cheeses that sort of runs this gamut from a very plain, basic store product that you buy in bulk. So this one here, Beecher's, this is £29. This was $29 for a pound of cheddar.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a very different world from the New York sharp cheddar or even your mass-produced Cracker Barrel, which is still sold under this generic brand of cheddar.
So it mentions one of the other tasting notes is to give this stuff some time, because as it's dissolving in your mouth, you know, 30 seconds later you may pick up new tastes. And the only additional part I'm thinking of as I'm chewing on it, hopefully not too loudly in people's ear, it's like definitely like a grassy, I think. You know, I imagine just sort of that's that fresh cow. And they mention how like the diet of whatever animals are eating will result in these sort of tastes. And I mean, I guess you'd expect the cows to have a grassy taste to it. But I think
to be fair, other than that little crunch, which you get now and again, there is... It was very tasty, but there is nothing I would sit here that to me, and I tend to be someone who just buys Irish cheddar for my sandwiches or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that truly differentiates it from any of them. If you gave that to me, I would just go, oh, it was a nice cheddar.
Yeah, well, I think it's better than average, but it's not like a shocker. But I mean, that's the thing is, you know, you as somebody who doesn't go in for all these crazy IPAs, what you like is a very, very good English ale. I would count this in the same idea that it's like, you know, no flaws. It's none of this like, oh, that doesn't taste right or there's something chemical to it or anything like that. It's a very well-made, fresh agricultural product.
Again, I could easily cut it up, put it on crusty bread, eat it with some chutney, which we will discuss a little bit later, maybe some fresh tomatoes, the very traditional, the way I was brought up, there's your cheese sandwich. So that is you want to move on?
Yeah, I mean, what I was just thinking about is as an agricultural product, I thought maybe we'll start a taste and I can talk a little bit about, you know, what we've got here.
All right, so the next cheese is an Italian cow's milk cheese. It is called Piave, P-I-A-V-E. It is from the Dolomites area, and the only, like champagne, the only official Piave has to come from the Dolomites. So if some dude in another part of Italy says, yeah, this is my Piave, that's great, but it is not the real deal in the way that technically Californian champagne isn't really champagne because it's not from the Champagne region of France. This is a hard-cooked cheese.
Is this the Piave Vecchio that you had sent the link for?
Yes.
Okay, so one thing is, you know, there's differences. It's all Piave, but done differently. Like, so Piave Fresco is 20 to 60 days of aging, whereas this stuff is aged for...
6 months.
6 months, okay. There's it basically seems to be in the middle of it because there's ones that go to a year or 18 months, and it's all Piave Vecchio, Piave this. You know, there's a Piave Vecchio Riserva, which is aged for more than 18 months, and they have different labels kind of thing. So,
according to Wikipedia, there are moments when it is clearly related to Parmigiano-Reggiano, but it is softer.
It is.
It is much softer and can be eaten, as we're eating it right now, just chunks of the stuff, whereas I never think of Parmesan. I mean, if I cut up a slice of Parmesan to eat as just eat, then it means my fridge is empty, right. I'm starving, and I have nothing else there.
Well,
because realistically, Parmigiano is always something that you have to grate to really eat it. This is softer and can just be bitten.
Nonetheless, it's definitely harder than the cheddar was, you know, because I'm just trying to break a stick of it, and it's harder. It's got a little bit of a, like a good cheese funk, you know, like a little bit of a smell. It's not, you know, it's not stinky cheese, but it's got a little bit of that.
I was going to say it has a very clean odor in the way that, you know, this is going to sound really idiotic, what I'm about to say. In the way that expensive spring water smells very sort of, you know, clean and fresh. Like, it has this funny... I think it's the same thing.
It's a strong cheese. I would say it's a little bit sweet. I don't know if there's sugars in cheese. I don't even know that part. But, you know, it's not a sweet, like a candy type of sweet, but sweeter than some other things.
Yeah, it doesn't have that sort of kind of very sharp edge that the cheddar has at the end. Doesn't have that at all. It's interesting that, and again, I don't want to get hung up on something I've read on the internet. It's interesting that...
We would never do that.
No. Like I say, it says that at some point in its aging process, it resembles that of a young Parmigiano Reggiano. But I must say, if I grated this and added it to something else, I'm not sure it is sharp enough to influence something else to the extent that Parmesan does. Like, Parmesan really elevates. It's like that old rule about don't never add Parmesan to your seafood because it just completely...
Oh, yeah.
Just takes it over.
This would be good, like, if you took the actual pieces like this rather than, like, grate it but had chunks of it in a salad.
Well, yeah, that's the thing.
I think that would work really well.
It goes down very well in terms of eating it right now. So, like, each one of us has probably, I don't know, an eighth of a pound of cheese of each of these cheeses. So definitely after this show, I'm going to probably be a little bit constipated for a couple of days.
So this is going to put us out of order, but the Parmesan's a good place to talk about it. Like when they create cheese, I'm going to talk a bit about what the heck cheese is, you know, because we all take it for granted. Nobody really thinks of like, okay, how did this end up getting from cow? And so far these two have been cow. You've obviously got other types of, you've got buffalo and you've got goat as the most popular ones.
Yep.
How do you get there? And one of the main things is you're separating the proteins in there from the water. And we'll talk a little bit about the chemistry that's associated with that, but you end up with sort of curdles in a mixture.
Right.
And whey is the watery substance left over. You don't really use that for anything, although sometimes they mix it in with stuff to bring in certain tastes. But then what you're trying to do is get rid of all that water. And the harder and drier cheese is, like how much effort they put in there. And so Parmesan, for example, and I'm assuming this stuff is put in like a steel spring form that keeps sort of squeezing it tighter and trying to get it down. Moreover, the more you age it, in addition to like new taste coming out, the more it's going to dry itself out, the more intensity you're going to get. For people who know like fancy steaks, they dry age a steak, which is really reducing the moisture content. And as a result... you know, increasing the taste content. You know, the more the waterier a product is, the less the intensity of the taste per bite, so to speak.
It is interesting. There is a notion with our modern diets and dairy that you have all these products, and it's too easy to forget that they're basically all the same thing at different points in their lifespan. So, and the reason I say that is when you were talking about the curd and the whey. Well, I immediately thought of yogurt. You can buy some yogurts where you open it and there's still that liquid on top. But ultimately, yogurt and cheese are basically the same thing,
just at different stages of aging. The real one that people can think about is cottage cheese.
Right.
So cottage cheese has all those chunks, but they've left a decent amount of liquid behind. And so you can picture a lot of cheeses will go through a phase that looks like that before people start messing with it more. Brief shout out while we're in the Parmesan family. Good friend of the pod, Brian, who recently, although he's always been a good friend of the pod and friend of ours, recently was checking out our episodes, which seems to me to imply that he didn't do it before. And it's only been 6 or 7 years now we've been doing this, so a little bit offended there. But he and another person who I recently heard from, not a friend of the pod yet, but Rob, they used to be on and on about Locatelli Parmesan. I don't remember if he was still...
I don't even know what that is.
It's some brand, but like realize that, you know, in the 80s when you had Parmesan at home, it was most likely that Kraft shaker of the grated stuff that was like 50% sawdust, basically.
Yes.
And then they had found this Locatelli. I think that Rob's family might have used this Locatelli brand or some variation on Parmesan. So it was all about getting a hold of some Locatelli for your pizza and, you know, or whatever it was you were going to put it on Italian dishes. I don't really remember. Was it really that great? And I haven't bothered to look it up yet. But shout out to Locatelli, Rob, and Brian.
Was it a block cheese that you grated?
Or I think it was, you know, like little squares of it. You know, they would grate it. Like, okay. It wasn't, you didn't get, I think you can buy it grated now, but I seem to recall them doing the grating.
Because the uninitiated, there's two forms of Parmesan. There's the stuff you have to grate or you buy grated, yeah. And then there's the stuff in the shaker. So yeah.
And they now make sort of like a shaved Parmesan by the tubs that people use in salads. Someone here in the household does that quite frequently.
Anyway, the before we move on, that the PR was too, I wouldn't, unlike a cheddar though, I'm not sure how much of it I would eat in one go.
No, that's, you know, like, where's the cheddar? I almost ate all the stuff that was here, but then I realized
the cheddar, you can plow through that. Cheddar is a cheese that's built, that is built. Cheddar is a cheese that has been cultivated to eat in large amounts.
Yeah, you can put it on puffs and all that sort
just
of other stuff.
Whole
you
know, block
like
of
some,
cheddar,
some
yeah.
variation of cheddar.
All right, so let's move on to our next cheese.
Well, let's real briefly, I think, because we're doing pretty well on time, right? So
yeah, 25 minutes in, but we're gonna have a little interlude. Okay.
Well, let me just mention a couple, just to go back on the, while I mentioned the squeezing of the cheese, the main thing about cheese, like what is cheese, is obviously it's starting with milk, but what they do is they're adding some enzymes that cause that separation. It changes the structure of the protein so that they solidify out of the milk, leaving behind the whey, you're doing the squeezing. The main traditional, and you know where it originally came from, the protein comes from something called rennet, which is comes from ruminating animals' stomachs. So ruminating animals are like cows and other things that have like the multiple stages of stomachs, and a lot of their digestion goes on through much more activity in their stomachs than we have. So this is what makes cheese.
But our brains ruminate.
Like cheese would not be vegan because, of course, it's using an animal's milk.
That's right.
But it could be vegetarian, right? Because it's just dairy. It's not eating meat, right? So, but the rennet that's associated with it is coming from animals. I think they use calf stomachs,
right?
If you're doing it traditionally. There's a whole bunch of other ways to make it nowadays, but that would be the traditional thing. So if you are a vegetarian but you eat cheese, you do have to make some selections of which cheeses you'll have, and that is a little bit difficult for them to find. So that's a vegetarian angle where, like, if you're looking for it, all the vegetarians who are out there, I'm sure, know this already. But
yes.
People aren't a vegetarian to know if you slap out some cheese on a table and think your friends are going to eat it when they're vegetarian, it's not necessarily true because, in fact, there may be killing of animals associated with the chemistry and the production of the cheese.
I'm trying to think if, like, a regular cheese square that you get, you know, the very traditional cheese. I'm trying to think, because that seems to be almost all oil. That's the criticism that the manufacturers throw at the other one, that their cheese is all oil. I'm trying to think how legitimately vegetarian those things are. And then I'm trying to think, it's so modern. It's like that old thing about white chocolate doesn't have any chocolate in it. I'm starting to think if a cheese square that's coming in cellophane wrapping.
I mean, a lot of those slices, I mean, some of them are, like, they'll say cheddar, but others are like cheese food. Because it doesn't pass the legal standard for being actual cheese. So the protein, we'll go on with the taste, but just to close out, the protein that is called casein, C-A-S-E-I-N, and is, in fact, the word is related to cheese. Like when you go to the Wikipedia page, which of course is what we're heavily relying on here, what is cheese, you know, this is stuff that goes back. The etymology of the word cheese goes way, way, way back, pre-Latin, you know, kind of words. And cheese comes from the Latin caseus, which is, of course, the same where the casein's coming from. But, of course, you know, it's as if, like, it's not like they knew at the time what was going on. They ended up with those words because they were related.
Yeah.
You know, it's almost reverse evolution of the language.
It came from.
Yep. Next cheese?
The next cheese is La Dama Gouda, or Gouda, depending how you want to say it. And I'm going to find my bit of paper here.
What was the brand you said?
This is the Yeah, this is the, sorry, this is the Lemieux Gouda.
Yeah, okay,
Gouda.
That's right.
Sorry,
that's
my notes are
Lemieux
wrong.
Lemieux signature Gouda.
So, before I start shoveling in.
Dutch.
This is, yeah, Dutch. And this is the first cheese out of the three. The other two cheeses so far have had that very, traditional is the wrong word, but that very light yellow color. This one is more clearly almost orange.
Mm-hmm. Now, it definitely has crystals in it.
Now, when I was talking about the cheddar, I made a point that cheddar is a cheese that you taste after. Meaning that a lot of cheddars, they you put them in your mouth and they build as you, mm-hmm. you know, as you chew and digest them. As soon as I put this in my mouth, it hit me all up front.
Okay.
And a long silence there on the microphone as my partner and I chew. Yeah, that interesting thing about the crystals, you can taste them now and again in this one. It's a Gouda, it came, or a Gouda, 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 came in a wheel.
It's a bit crumbly. Like, so people, you can get Gouda, it's almost like a soft cheese if you buy a store brand, like, you know, the, it's a real piece of cheese, not just slices, but the blocks at the grocery store.
According to the website Cheese Culture, which is a website that's all about cheese, it's called Culture, the word on cheese. The milk for this cheese comes from the quiet canal-lined pastures of northern Holland.
Okay.
So apparently it's to do with the fact that the landscape is below 20 foot below sea level on reclaimed land from the sea. So the soil and the grass create this very unique profile for the cows that then help produce this cheese. And while, you know, I say that with that voice like I'm almost making fun of it, that you made the point earlier. This is one of those products which is a direct reflection of whatever the animal was eating.
Right.
More so than, and I can't sit here and tell you that I've eaten enough free-range chicken to sit here and tell you that, oh, there's a difference in flavor. To me, all chicken tastes about the same. Like, I never eat chicken and suddenly go, oh, it's not like, do you know, I find chicken very easily identifiable. And so I've never eaten enough free-range animals or even beef to sit here and really go, yeah, if my eyes closed, I could honestly tell the difference. Whereas I think with cheese, because of the relationship with the cow and that, you know, everything that comes out of the cow, it is much more, it's going to taste of where it is.
Yeah.
Which is why cheese has so many geographical variations around the world, which is not the same for beef, to be fair.
Variation is much more subtle. You know, I have had grass-fed beef and been like, okay, that definitely tastes different. Doesn't taste like grass, but definitely tastes different than...
Different to the extent that you would know... If I just put two plates of beef in front of you, you would instantly be able to.
I mean, if I was able to taste them side by side, like I wouldn't be like if you gave me a steak, be like, oh, that's a grass-fed one.
Okay.
But if I had two tastes of steak at the same time, I think I'd be able to tell the difference between the two.
Okay.
But again, it's not. It doesn't really come through as grass. It just comes through like a leaner texture. It's like free-range chicken, I find, is really mostly different in the sense that it doesn't have that sort of squishy, fatty kind of feel, like the muscles weren't fully utilized. Whereas
it's
a free-range
chicken slightly different
like
texture
bit,
rather than...
You know, a little bit more towards gamey and, like, actually used bodies. It's good. Definitely, like I mentioned, the crystal stuff, which I'm looking here, and it's mentioning that's protein crystals is what we're getting. This one was aged 2 years, and you can tell it's significantly more pronounced in its taste than your average Gouda that you might get over and put on a sandwich. You know, you can melt a Gouda on, like, some good sandwiches with some melted Gouda on them, but I don't think I would do that with this. This is
You make a really excellent point there. This is a cheese I would sample, but I'm not sure, and I made the point about that the cheese just now that when we were talking about Parmesan. This is definitely a cheese that you would add to something to elevate something else.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, we've made a cheese sauce out of this or whatever it may be. I'm not sure that on that very base level, for me, my primary relationship with cheese is putting on a bit of bread.
Yeah, you mentioned it before we got on here all about that. So
yeah,
time
well,
to talk
I mean, and
it.
I guess this is a good moment to talk about it. I, 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 on the spot in the studio, in the green room before, I created this theory.
It is literally green room.
That, yeah, that cheese is one of those products that, that was, we talked a lot about, we were just talking about beef. Well, you cook beef and it is the center of the meal. Well, you can have a cheese sandwich, you can have cheese on your pizza, you can add cheese to your pasta, you can have a queso cheese dip sauce.
Eggs and cheese.
Right. The cheese can be used to make desserts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cheese blints and cheesecake. What I'm saying, cheese is this very sort of malleable product that can take on many roles within your diet, whereas beef... No one goes, oh, yeah, I'm going to have something and maybe put a little beef on the side. No, yeah, right, you beat beef, you go and eat a steak.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that. I don't mean that facetiously. I mean, well, you know, most other proteins tend to be the star of the meal, whereas cheese is a protein that can live, that can take on various roles. Again, you can have a cheese sandwich and there's your lunch. You can have an omelet and throw a bit of cheese on it and it makes that omelet. Takes it to the next level. Cheese can be dessert.
People undersell the merits of a cheese sandwich, right?
They really do.
Like, you know, I think people probably think of that as kids' food in the States at least, but, you know, you could make a pretty good just cheese and some other ingredient sandwich.
Cheese and tomato, cheese and just some thin slices of onion. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is the moment when it's time to talk about a very British thing.
Yeah, I know. How did you end up the jar on your side of the wall there?
Well, because I'm going to put it on my plate first.
Okay.
So I have in front of me something called Branston pickle. And we've just made the case that a cheese sandwich, a good cheese sandwich, good cheese, good bread, either toasted or no toasted, that's a meal. That's, you can, you know, depending obviously on how much you're eating, but, you know, that's your main course. So when I was a kid in England, I was first introduced to something called Branston pickle.
Mm-hmm.
And... I'm gonna let you take the jar. Hold on, we're gonna open the door here in the in the upstairs studio. And my partner has the jar of Branston pickle, and this is basically, it's a relish or a chutney, or depending where you are in the world, it is basically a product made up of chopped diced onion. Depending on the variants, there might be some diced carrot in there. And then there is a sauce of molasses and sugar and spices made together. And it is a wonderful complement, first of all, to cheese, but you can use it on all kinds of things. Branston pickle, Branston is the brand. They are sort of the leader in UK of the pickle / chutney.
I'm having a hard time because you mentioned the ingredients and what it could be. So I'm like, well, what is this one? It's a little hard to read, but it appears to say vegetables in variable proportion. 52% vegetables, and it says carrot, rutabaga, onion, cauliflower.
Well,
I can't read the rest. Tomato paste, vinegar.
It is a pickle in the very traditional sense that in many, many cultures, you pickle vegetables to allow them to last longer.
Right.
So this is what this is, but it is a relish that goes very well, I think, in my opinion, goes very well with cheeses. My partner's looking at me through the screen. He is not as convinced.
Well, I can see how it goes. I do not particularly like the taste of this particular relish, but
okay.
That is, in fact, a known... The reason when you get a cheese board somewhere, it's got grapes and these vegetables and pickles, is because it's counterpoint to those cheeses that, as I'm finding out with just eating a bunch of cheese in a row, your mouth is just full of that protein, and it's hard to, like, move on to the next one without still tasting the old one.
Yes.
Whereas the acidity of a pickle cuts through that, or, like, you know, just something, even the, like, the crackers, you know, you could put your cheese on your cracker, but just eating the cracker itself between the two can kind of
help sort of clean your palate a little bit.
Yeah.
Which comes back to our point about white wine that they told me in the store when I was buying these, that ultimately with cheese, especially if you're doing what we're doing, which is sampling many of them, you do need to find a way to sort of reset your palate and start over.
I have to go get the rest of the cheeses.
Yeah.
So maybe you want to start talking about cheese plates as a general matter, right? So this nowadays at some nice restaurants, crafty kind of American restaurants, they have that.
Right.
But it's not traditionally been a part of
no,
American
so,
cuisine, I mean, but you were mentioning, in addition to, like, you said, okay, either you put it on a sandwich or you would be at a fancy restaurant and have a cheese board. And I saw something, for example, that classically in England or Great Britain, I guess probably England proper, your cheese board would be like with some port wine at the same time,
right.
Whereas
so
the French is a slight variation where they would have them in sequential order, that where you'd have wine and you'd have cheese sort of separately, but around the same part of the meal.
I always think of it as an expensive restaurant or a Northern European thing where, you know, you might have dessert and then cheese after that, or have cheese instead of your dessert. And, you know, I'm sure if you go to a more upscale restaurant, although to say that, one of the best meals I ever had was in a small town in France at a hotel, and they brought their cheese board around for dessert, and, you know, you selected three cheeses, and, you know, I remember asking, which is this, which is that, and the lady attempted in you know, her native French and broken English to sort of tell me what the difference was, but I picked three cheeses and that was dessert. And of course, you know, it would come with a couple of grapes and what have you. And of course, you know, now I hate to use this word, it's a very hipster thing to be like, yes, we've done charcuterie, which is cheese and cured meats and what have you. So it is interesting how, again, and maybe this runs on my original point, that cheese is able to run the gamut of being, you know, leader of the pack, be an accent in terms of a sauce, or in this instance, there's because of its dairy nature, it is able to, it goes very well with sweet and savory. And I don't think that's always the case with a lot of other products. I can't think of any, I guess you can have Korean barbecue, you can have barbecue sauce with beef and pork, but in general, that there is something about cheese where it works with all extremes of the palate, from mm-hmm. sweet and sour. And like I say, in expensive restaurants in Europe, cheese is something you have at the end of the meal. Whereas nowadays, it's very sort of hip and modern to have it as do you want to have charcuterie?
Right. Well, it fits more with the American sort of a technique of a meal where the centerpiece is like a bunch of entree, like meats and things in the beginning, your appetizer with, mix it with sausage and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So let me tell you, why don't we have another taste, and I'm going to tell you why I think, in connecting it into its manufacture, why I think that it is that it works with so many different things. So
okay.
We have, what's our next is the...
So this is the La Dama Sagrada we're about to try. And as my partner tries it first, it comes from Spain's La Mancha region, a man of La Mancha, where, of course, Don Quixote took on the windmills. Mm-hmm. That's what it says on the internet. And it's also from an area where Manchego is very, very popular. And of course, Manchego...
Like this brand makes a Manchego, but this is not really a Manchego.
Manchego is sheep's milk, and I'm now attempting to La Dama Sagrada is a goat's milk cheese. So this is our first cheese that's gone beyond the cow end of dairy. I guess goat, anything with milk counts as dairy, but this is no longer cow dairy.
We actually have some Manchego, Boar's Head Manchego in the fridge, but I didn't open that up because I thought this was going to be too close to this.
So when they make this cheese, the milk curds are first cooked. So they are heated until they're firmed. And then at that moment, all the liquid is drained out. Then they're put into the molds, and then they're brined and then aged for 6 months. So this is a cheese where the temperature of the original product has gone up. In terms of its production, in order to help all the liquid escape out of it,
right?
And like I say, this is from the same area where Manchego, which is a very flavorful cheese, comes from. Now I haven't tried it yet, so before I try it, I want you to be ready to discuss it, because then I'm going to come back with a couple of other things depending on what you say.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to say some things not about the cheese per se, but we'll come back to that while you're chewing on it, which is really another thing. Again, you alluded to the heat, and it all ties in well with the manufacture, which I think results in it having all these different roles. And that is that I was surprised when I started to do sort of the scientific part of the research on the cheese, is just the wide, wide variation in the steps involved. Like, so sure, you do something to separate out the curds and the whey, but there's a bunch of different ways to do that. You can do that with just straight acidification. You can do that with rennet. You can do it with these other sort of products, each of which is creating a different flavor. You've got the multiple animals from which the milk is coming from, so it's going to change its flavor. You've got what the animals are going to eat, which is going to change its flavor. You've got some versions that are done all at room temperature, non-pasteurized, and et cetera. And then you have cheeses like this, and I think the Parmesan also involves some heat, and you put some heat on it in order to develop it. You then have like different types of bacteria that are cultivated in it to grow things. We're going to talk about one very standard one shortly here. But there's so many different variations to take it different directions. It is really unlike, like originally I was thinking of, you know, other things you taste, beer, wine, or other products like that. But they don't have that wide of coffees, you know, they don't have that wide of variation in how you can produce it. This is, I mean, they're almost like they're not the same product with all the different things that can be done other than the fact you did this first step of treating the milk in order to separate out parts of it and get that casein behaving differently than it does in the liquid form. But everything else from there is a different variation on what can be done. And so therefore, of course, it can do everything. I mean, of course, you know, it might as well be comparing corn to wheat to barley to, you know, even that, I don't know if that captures all the variation, but it's you know, it's a manufactured food with just so many things that have come up for it. You can imagine everybody's tailoring it to it or developing uses for it. Keep in mind that while nobody knows, because cheese predates history, I think, you know, like the earliest mention is like Pliny the Elder or something mentioning in those, you know, old Greek texts or something, but it was an accident to begin with. We assume, because of course people used animal stomachs for storage purposes, and undoubtedly somebody put milk into one of those things, and because of the chemistry of the rennet, ended up with something new. And from there on out, you know, what could we do? How do we stumble into this? It probably evolved in different locations concurrently. You know, it's not like cheese would invent in one place and then made its way around, just the same way that, you know, fire would show up, you know, independently in different places. And so you can imagine as they did it, they're both trying to shape it, but also being like, well, look what we've got here, and it hasn't gone bad. What should we do with it? And almost coming up with the purposes for the cheese. You can go either direction.
Cheese is also one of those products, for want of a better word. And I'm thinking back now a couple of years to when we did the home brewing show, where we worked in the same location and you walked us through the steps. And there was a lot of like, well, this is what it's going to look like later routine. If you talk about, you know, people start doing things different ways, but the one thing that is common to cheese in terms of the process is time. In that there's no way to sort of bung together, hey, let's make some cheese this weekend.
Yeah, we're not, you know, like you can make a cheese very quickly. I mean, you can make a cheese at home out of a milk in the right chemistry, but it's going to be like cottage cheese. Everything else from there is but how long it hangs around, which really has to do with that storage stuff, which we mentioned, the refrigeration. I mean, that the whole point was to create a food product
time is
that you could carry with you.
Time is a key ingredient to making as what we're doing here, which is hard cheeses, I think is the best thing to say. So what did you think of that?
I didn't love it.
I didn't love it either,
but
it was interesting as I was reading it.
But it's maybe just not my taste.
It is a goat's milk cheese.
Yeah.
And knowing that then made me think of, you know, what's the most accessible goat's milk cheese that we all use that you buy in the store? Feta cheese.
Yeah.
Yeah, feta cheese crumbles, it's there. It is, you know, feta cheese is the cornflakes of goat's milk cheeses, right? It's the one, it's almost like the brand. So knowing now, I'm not saying my palate and my knowledge are refined enough if I didn't know that when I ate it. Knowing that when I eat this, I'm like, okay, I now taste how goat's milk creates a slightly different flavor profile than dairy milk, the traditional cow milk.
I think that's right. You know, it's interesting when you say it's like feta. I think if I was the brand people, I imagine this is illegal because a number of cheese brands are based around like wines. You can't call it something that it's not. But this the saying for this one would be the betta feta.
Yes.
Because it's like what you're trying to say. Feta, you know, yeah. Sure, you guys have all had that regular feta all the time, but try the better feta. And you like upgrade your feta taste, and this would attract.
You can email them in Spain's La Mancha region,
yeah.
And they will probably dismiss you as another.
Well, I imagine you know
American.
Feta like whoever owns the rights on feta would then immediately sue the better feta people because they'd say you can't no more than you can like claim
you
it's a different product. It can't be like
wanna,
beer is the better wine.
Said, I want to take what you said there. I'm going to take it entirely at face value. Feta is always something I'm going to put on something else. But I would never just eat feta. I wouldn't. Now, this cheese, though, I could see myself cutting it and slamming it on a nice piece of French bread. Fresh French bread. I would eat this on its own. Whereas feta, I would never sit there. Me, personally, I would never sit there and cut up feta. Feta is an accent cheese. In the same way when we talked about Parmesan. Parmesan is an accent cheese.
Yeah.
This version, the better feta, I'd be tempted to eat not loads of it, but I could eat it as is on some good bread.
See, what I haven't figured out, like, would it be melted or you just eat it like this?
I would eat it, but I just wouldn't be able to, because it's got quite a bitter taste, quite a sharp taste, I wouldn't eat too much of it, but I could eat it.
Yeah, I
mean, feta, I don't know, feta I would only ever sprinkle.
If you have a hard cheese on bread, it's hard for it to come through. I mean, you'd almost have to like have a, you'd have to have your $50 chunk of cheese on a piece of French bread in order to even notice it.
So here's the thing now about cheese. You know, and again, we keep coming back to this base idea of the cheese sandwich. The cheese sandwich is the blend of bread and cheese. But what you're saying is a cheese like this needs a very good bread to help accent it.
Well, but not too much bread either. Like that's
cheddar,
the thing is like
you can maybe make
little sandwiches, little itty bitty sandwiches where it was like 50-50 cheese and bread. But you can't do that. You're not going to make a whole sandwich of this stuff.
No.
Because it would be like, I mean, you know, it'd be difficult on the innards afterwards.
Yes. Before we get on to our next cheese, I wanted to divert and talk about a cheese product, a cheese meal that I had a couple of weeks ago. Which is a variant on the toasted cheese sandwich. And I'm only mentioning it because it caused some discussion at the time amongst the people I'm with. It is called Welsh Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Welsh Rabbit, basically, rabbit is a old Anglo-Celtic Saxon Gaelic term for melting cheese on bread. But unlike the American grilled cheese sandwich, where the cheese is placed inside the bread and then cooked, rabbit... The cheese is put on the bread and then cooked under the broiler, so it melts down onto the bread. But anyway, I had very tasty Welsh rarebit with this interesting tomato sort of, not relish is the wrong word, but like chopped up tomato and cute sort of a tomato-y salad. But also they had put a fried egg or a poached egg on top of it, and it was just a very nice different way of basically having bread and cheese,
yeah,
and an egg.
Do you need to shout out that restaurant for a free meal?
No.
Okay.
Because, no, I mean, it was put it this way. It was good Welsh rarebit, but Welsh rarebit is something I feel like I could make at home. So, no, I'm not going to shout them out. But okay. I'm going to give them a bit of love for at least trying it. So, anyway, we have one more of our high-end artisan cheeses to try. Why don't you go ahead and taste while I...
okay.
This is a blue cheese. So, while I said that, you know, to go back to the start of the show, I'm standing in the artisanal cheese shop confronted by cases of like 50 different cheeses and like, wow, I've only got to pick four or five. I had no idea what to do. I suddenly became conscious of the fact, let's have some variety. Thinking back to the fact that cheese is a dessert or a charcuterie product, I then picked a blue cheese to finish. They had standard versions of the very British Stilton, which is one of the original blue cheeses. They were Maytag, whatever. But this one is from, is this the Point? I'm trying to think. This is
Point
Bay
Rays,
Blue.
Which I don't, the Point, you know, it's mentioned being Bay Blue, but I don't, what bay? Is this American, English? What is this?
San Francisco.
Okay.
So it comes from a dairy near Point Ray Station, which is just an hour north of San Francisco. It looks like it is a family that started this cheesery, I guess that's the word. Milk all for the production of all their cheeses, including this Bay Blue, comes from the herd of cows that graze the pastures overlooking to Marlis Bay.
Yeah.
Her production for Bay Blue begins at 3:30 in the morning when milk is pumped to the cheese room in time for the morning's cheese making. From there, it's pasteurized. After the wheels are formed, cheeses are allowed to sit in their molds overnight. They're then, after a day, they are hand-salted over 3 days, a repetitive process, and then they are cured for about 3 weeks. And then they mature for 3 months after that. Apparently with blue cheeses, they do a lot of, they're not just adding things, but there's a lot of talk of piercing them and turning them as part of their process.
Well, you mentioned it as a mold, right? That's the whole point, right? Like, so in fact, blue cheese is, I think, a penicillin mold. I don't think it's the same one as the one who, you know, I'm sure there's variations on penicillin, but that's where they're, when you stick things in there, what you're trying to do is plant that mold in there deeper so it'll run through there. This one, despite a lot of blue and the ribbons running through it, is not the strongest I've ever had in terms of the blue. And I mean that in a good way. Like, it's, this is a very useful cheese. I can see in a lot of different scenarios. You know, the little write-up mentions it being a star of the after-dinner piece, you know, to have with your port wine. And, you know, you put in meat. I mean, one of the nice things is if you have a steak, is having some blue cheese, melted blue cheese, not a ton of it, or you can get a burger with some blue cheese melted on there. It's very, very good, as long as you can keep it from totally disappearing. The problem when you melt this stuff on there is, you know, by the time you actually get around to eating it, there's no actual cheese left on top because it's all just melted off and fell around the side. But like the original blue cheese, I think, is Roquefort, which was, and these are all, again, obviously they stumbled into it. Nobody was like, even probably knew at that point what
Roquefort
they were dealing
was
with
the
in
French
terms of penicillin.
Blue cheese, and then in England, it was Stilton was the English sort of variant. I like blue cheese, but I can't say I'm a huge fan of this one.
What's that? You're not?
I like blue cheese, but I can't say I'm a huge fan of this one.
Because?
I don't know. It has a very... I can crunch the crystals, which is clearly now... I'm going to now make a statement that if you can taste the crystals, that is a reflection of the very artisanal... production of your cheese. I don't know. I find it quite peppery.
In it, like
I don't know. I would use this on something, but I would never. And again, I like blue cheese. I'll select a blue cheese as one of the three cheeses if I'm having cheese for dessert. I'm more than happy on the charcuterie. I know some people don't like it. It smells too much, and my fingers smell of it. They stay away from it. I'll eat it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't want to be too critical of our friends at who have created the Bay Blue, but
I quite like it.
You do?
Yeah. Mm. It's sweet. It's sugary and salty. It's got enough salt where I could kind of feel a little flush from. Like, sometimes when I eat salty foods, I suddenly am like, I'm getting a little sweaty here. But it's also sweet at the same time. So like all the good snacks, sweet and salty, put it together.
Yeah. You know? I don't know.
It's got a lot of awards, although
yes.
I don't know how that works. You know, I'm not really super duper familiar with
I want to be very fair. This is me not liking it. I don't know. There's something about it, but it's very flavorful. Very, you know, it's not, I don't like it because it's, it's not a case of me not liking it because I don't taste of anything.
Yeah.
Very tasty. I don't know.
I was starting to tell a story straight out of Wikipedia. The history, like the legendary history, which I'm unsure is not true, was that the first Roquefort was discovered when a young boy eating bread and ewe's milk cheese abandoned his meal in a nearby cave after seeing a beautiful girl in the distance and came back months later and had Roquefort cheese.
Oh, okay.
I don't know how it went with the girl, though.
Yeah. I'm trying to figure out if the fact that he had to come back for a meal was a reflection on how that relationship went. I can't decide if that relationship ended badly, so he had to scour back to his cave to look for his cheese sandwich that he had left months prior.
That's the sort of
behavior I would exhibit if I was in a bad place.
This cheese makes the particular point, like on their own website, that it's made with the rennet, so it's a traditional manufacturing and definitely not vegetarian. You know, what's interesting is you would think as a moldy item, or my initial instinct was this would be an older cheese, but it's really not. I think it's 60 days or something like that. It's aged, which kind of makes it's pretty soft to begin with, and it's meltable and all that.
So I do want to pick up, and again, it's interesting here. So I'm looking more about this blue cheese, and it says that the perfect pairing is a glass of vintage port or barrel aged scotch.
Mm-hmm.
And I can, I do, I like, I quite like a glass of port now and again. And I do see that, that, you know, while in essence that breaks this sort of very generic, very generalized rule that Nick from Cheesty gave me about white wine going best with cheese, I can actually see that this is one of those instances where I think a blue cheese, a red wine going with it, suddenly.
Well, I think he's probably describing if you're having a bunch of cheeses, whereas this would be if you just sat down and had a bit of blue cheese and something else, like, you know, that's your only thing.
And so they say that in the kitchen, Bay Blue is a great topper for a succulent steak or burger.
That's what
very true. But it also says shaved onto poached pears or grilled peaches. And I only say that because, again, that underlines this notion that the cheese is, it's the MVP of the kitchen. They can do everything, pretty much, can't it?
Yeah.
Because, again, I mean, you know, on its own, blue cheese is a very strong, distinctive flavor. But you can accent a dessert, and clearly they recommend doing so. So I'm almost tempted to try this on something like that just to see how it works. So
quick note about scotches. I was recently given a bottle of Copper Fox by Detective Mike for dog sitting for their dog.
I do want to give a shout out. Before you finish, I do want to give a shout out to Detective Mike. Did we not wish him a happy birthday?
No, you're mixing up people. That was Improvised Explosive Dave.
Okay. So sorry, Detective Mike. But Improvised Explosive Dave, one of our fans, we left him a birthday greeting on
personal
request.
Yeah, like, I don't think you should say that because somebody else is going to ask for it. It was a bit of a hard way to figure out how to.
The people can ask for it, but now we're charging. So that's going to put people
like
off a little.
Cameo, isn't Cameo the website where you can like you can get celebrities to do little video greetings, anything you want?
Oh, really?
Different prices.
Well, but we're now in that business.
Yeah. So, Detective Mike gave me a Copper, which is a Virginia-made scotch. At first, I thought it was like a scotch version of bourbon or something like where they mess with it, but it is pretty much, and they make a number of other liquor products, but it's in Sperryville, I think, Virginia. And I think it was the first place around, certainly around Virginia, if not further reaches, where they have a traditional kiln, you know, malting floor where you spread out all the stuff and get it to sprout. And rather than smoke it with peat, because we don't have peat around here, and I don't, by peat, I mean P-E-A-T, the stuff that grows in Scotland. They smoke it with fruit woods. I think, I can't remember if it's apple or other types of fruit woods that they're using to smoke it. It's pretty good. It's very like leathery, but I could see it going with this stuff.
I was going to ask you,
Mike.
That was the question I had for you. Was it distinctive?
I briefly have toyed with the idea of having, you know, one of my New Year's resolution be catch up on the scotches, but yeah. There's only so much room in the liquor cabinet. You know,
right.
I'm still like working off the tequilas and the bourbon, so.
Well, so, because I use that word, I said distinctive there on purpose, because that's the interesting thing about all these cheeses, is that ultimately, and we still have one to go that we're going to use as sort of our comparison,
mm-hmm.
I found that the most indistinct of the five cheeses was the cheddar. Now, I want to defend it a little bit. It was very good cheddar, but cheddar is sort of the mass marketplace cheese. I'm trying to think, what was the other one? I thought I did enjoy the Gouda, and I enjoyed a lot the Piave, which was the one that was almost like the softer Parmesan cheese. I
think the Gouda and the Blue might be the most of the ancient styles. Like, I think the Italians, these very harder dried cheese are probably, and by me, more modern inventions. I mean, like in the last 2,000 years versus,
right, yeah.
You know. But because of the fact it would take more manufacturing effort, whereas the blue cheese is still pretty soft. It hasn't been super-duper pressed. It's really just, you know, taking advantage of the mold and the Gouda.
Gouda
is apparently, like, one of the oldest styles that we still have. Like, obviously, I think it came from, like, the 1100s or something like that.
It is interesting. The blue cheese is clearly the one that it's – I want to be careful how I put this. Really is sort of the course of nature.
Yeah, right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like farmhouse ales or beers. Like, it's not necessarily relying on Ukraine, these different things, like, although, you know.
All right, so as a comparison, and then again, it's a very unfair comparison. We're going to make a comparison. So all these cheeses that we got were clearly, you know, high-end, sold as high-end cheeses. Each one retail was anywhere from $28 to $33 a pound. You have a last cheese.
Yeah, it's like a standard cheese we have around the house. It's Jarlsberg Swiss, which is a variation on an Emmentaler Swiss cheese. Because, I mean, Emmentaler is really, when we think of Swiss cheese in America, it's all Emmentaler variations. Right. In other words, there's other cheeses made in Switzerland, but it's a semi-soft cheese.
Well, I mean, I must say, I do like a Jarlsberg.
Yeah. Well, you know, you, like Swiss, you make it but, out like but, it's like super, it's 50% cheaper than the others. Like, so it's not junk cheese, you know, it's, but it's.
I think it's interesting. I like Swiss cheese, but when you have Jarlsberg that has a slightly more, a stronger flavor, regular Swiss cheese just seems like some product that's thrown up there on the deli counter.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, Jarlsberg is strong enough that you could easily put it on a platter with these other cheeses, and it would pretty much hold its own in that it's distinct enough. It has a flavor profile that is familiar to folk, but it's also strong enough where, yeah, I can taste that. Yeah, I need to clear my palate a little bit, which I think ultimately is... I think it's fair to say that, and I know this probably applies to any kind of food, the cheaper something is, the less distinctive its flavor is. And I definitely think that's the case with cheese. When you go in there, and again, the Beecher's cheddar, which was the cheese we started with, if you go there at a deli counter and just order whatever the house cheddar is, and then have the Beecher's, the house cheddar isn't going to taste of anything, whereas the Beecher's tastes of something. And I know that seems very simplistic and a facile way of doing it, but you know, to mix up farm animal foods, regular cheeses is just chicken.
Yeah,
you know, these cheeses are all a good steak, and Jarlsberg has enough flavor to.
Yeah, well, so I mean, it's worth just culturally. It's one of the first that came here. I mean, think about it like Heineken beer, in the sense that it may not be the best, but it was the beginnings of people sort of expanding their palates. I think it started coming here in the 50s. By the way, Jarlsberg, not made in Switzerland, made in Norway, also Ireland and Ohio under license. It is the number one imported cheese in the United States.
Really?
And has been coming here since, I think, the 50s or so. So you can imagine, you know, when this arrived, this would be an exotic cheese relative to other things when all you were having was, you know, the Vermont cheddars and whatever else. And you probably didn't have a lot of gourmet stuff near you anyway. A lot of Velveeta, maybe, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So you know, I think you can't undersell it. I mean, it's obvious. It's not quite as interesting as all those, but it's not uninteresting, and it's got a nutty flavor. It's semi-soft, so it's the closest we've had to a soft cheese.
I'm going to say,
you
this.
Know, when you bend it, it bends. It doesn't just crumble apart in your hands.
If you're going to go to the effort of making your own macaroni and cheese, where you're going to boil the noodles and make your own sauce, Jarlsberg, with its combination of price point and flavor, is an ideal cheese to use as the base for your sauce to elevate an everyday dish and make it seem more gourmet, but also without breaking the bank. It's this quite, utilitarian is the wrong word, but it's this quite, you know, it's quite nimble and flexible. And like
of course,
I said,
it goes in your fondue. It's a mixture of Jarlsberg and Gruyere cheese, usually.
Gruyere is another cheese that I would put with Jarlsbergers. Yeah, you can eat it straight, but if you cook with it, all of a sudden you seem like you're a super great chef.
Exactly.
Whereas some of these other, put it this way, I wouldn't, some of these other cheeses, if I'd spend that much money for, I might use a little bit to sort of lift up a sauce or something, but, you know, I'm not doing. Whereas Jarlsberg, yeah, give me a pound and a half of that, and I'll grate it and bung it in the sauce.
Is the kind of cheese that's on top of a French onion soup? Is it Swiss or is it a different type?
I think that's Gruyere.
Okay.
I think that's Gruyere, yeah.
So it also has holes, right? Everybody loves holes. I mean, kids love the holes in there, especially when you slice it, so it's like the holes go all the way through. Apparently, in the real cheese world, those are called eyes of the cheese as opposed to holes. And it's really bubbles of carbon dioxide that are produced by some of the bacteria and things they introduce to give it its particular taste. Apparently, in earlier days, it was considered to be fancier if you could avoid the holes. So presumably, like, whoever's manufacturing it would take pains to try to work the holes out of it.
Really?
So that, like, you wouldn't have holes in there and that'd be fancier. But along the way, they must have realized this is like our trademark is the holes in the cheese.
Yeah.
We're going to leave the holes in the cheese kind of thing. You know, because of the holes in the trees, what weighs more, a pound of Swiss cheese or a pound of regular cheese?
Well, they weigh the same.
Exactly. It's a trick question. You got to spring that on your young relatives.
Can I say this? As you went with the other one and gave them the phrase, the better feta,
mm-hmm.
if I'm Jarlsberg, your tagline should be, the hole is where the heart is.
There you go.
Oh, there you go.
It's not bad. And that one won't have the trademark problems that the feta reference does.
Anything else?
Well, the only thing I wanted to say, and this will come back to a theme we've said before, is what would you say is a bit of a trick question? Which one's the best? Like,
in terms of eating them in the form that we have them right now, I'm going to say from our first couple. I mean, again, I'm a sucker for a cheddar. And again, I'm now going to say I really like the cheddar, and now I'm going to put the boot in because I think that price point for a cheddar is far too much
because
mm-hmm. cheddar's an everyday stay. But I like the Beaches a lot. I like the Piave a lot. I must say, I'm not a big fan of feta, but I think I tried to make the case there for that La Dama that you could eat it, not as much of it, but it was definitely, if you put it in front of me with a knife and a couple of crackers, I would eat that and go, oh, that was nice.
Yeah.
So if I got to pick one, I'm going to say I really like the Piave a lot because it did have some of that strength of Parmesan, but you could actually eat it without, you know, feeling like
like eating stone. The I thought the Gouda and the blue cheese were the best, but the reason I said it's a trick question is because they're so different and the roles will be so different.
Yeah,
you know, like you said, you can narrow it down to like this way, but if you said you have to have one cheese in your house for here going forward, how could you pick, right? Like, because it's too many different uses. I guess you'd find out what is your most predominant use of that cheese, and therefore you'd pick based on that.
I think that's what it is. I mean, I think with cheese, you have to decide what you're doing, and then there is this whole world of cheeses to select.
Yeah.
And again, I mean, that's why I made that point about Jarlsberg, that if you're making your own mac and cheese, Jarlsberg's great, and it's not super expensive.
Yeah.
I do think we'll probably have to do a show. I don't know anything about wine, and have we ever done a wine show?
No, we haven't.
And maybe we need to do a wine show, but because I don't know anything about wine, I think it would be interesting for us to do, or the next time we drink beer, we need to think about what would we eat with it, rather than just, I know when we do beer, we found different reasons to drink. We did beer and their names, but I think it would be interesting to try and pair up beers with food, which I know is not something that was traditionally mm-hmm. done. People sort of turn their nose up to beer a little bit.
Yeah, the wine, we might need a guide. And the other trick with the wine is because you're getting it in bottles, like if you want to taste 8 wines, you know, you better be planning a party immediately afterwards.
That's true, yeah.
You're really going to end up throwing a lot of things away or, you know, falling asleep during the broadcast.
All right, there's your cheese show. This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for the Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.